Under surveillance right here at home. Today, Thursday, July 10th. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. A Muslim American lawyer tries to understand why he may be the target of NSA surveillance.
Is it because my parents are from India? Is it because I'm Muslim? Because my name is Asim Ghaffour? I hate to have to even have this conversation, but that's really the only explanation.
Also, why some young Latin American baseball players use performance-enhancing drugs.
It's a hugely life-changing sum of money that's on the table if they manage to stand out from the crowd.
Plus, file this under the heading, Who Knew? Ireland loves Garth Brooks.
We have people that are going for their honeymoon to Garth Brooks. We've brides that actually considered cancelling their weddings for Garth Brooks. It's been phenomenal.
But will he or won't he play Dublin? Stick around and find out.
Support for PRI's The World comes from Medtronic, celebrating people living with medical technology who are giving back to their communities. Apply for the Bakken Invitation Award and earn a $20,000 charitable grant for your charity. Learn more at liveongiveon.org.
I'm Marco Werman, and you're tuned to The World. Knowledge is power, they say, which pretty much explains why governments spy to get power and why former surveillance contractor Edward Snowden lifted the veil on the NSA to expose what he saw as the agency's abuse of power. The latest revelation, based on documents leaked by Snowden, exposes this. The NSA and the FBI allegedly targeted five prominent Muslim Americans for surveillance. Legally, that would have required a warrant from a Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court, also known as a FISA court. The alleged targets included a professor, a Republican Party operative, and two civil rights activists, and also Asim Ghaffour, an attorney who's represented clients in terrorism-related cases. He gave me his reaction today.
It was unbelievable, shocking, really. For me, also, it was deja vu all over again. I had a case back in 2004 of having been surveilled by the government when speaking with clients by email and phone. This was the first time, however, where my email address was actually in a government database. The other was, 10 years ago, was circumstantial. It was other people being surveilled. I happened to be talking to them. In this case, it was my name in there. And as a U.S. citizen, that just sends a chill down your spine and not knowing if it's even completed. According to the spreadsheet, it was from 2005 to 2008, and it may still be going on today.
What were you doing professionally during this period when you were under surveillance?
I'm a civil rights lawyer, and I was suing the government, and I was winning, ironically. 2005 to 2008, I was in the throes of my previous lawsuit. I was challenging frozen assets cases. I was involved in many civil rights cases here, immigration cases and others, asking the government to grant immigration benefits to my clients. And I've been very successful, thank God. And why the government would listen to a lawyer's conversations, what they would get out of a lawyer's emails, how they would walk into court and tell the judge that, oh, we know Mr. Ghaffour's next motion because we've been surveilling his email. It just makes no sense.
What raised the government's attention to you? I mean, you've worked as a legislative aide on Capitol Hill. You've been in meetings with George W. Bush and Hillary Clinton, and now you find out this. I mean, you're on a list with people like Anwar al-Awlaki.
I'm very hesitant to play the race card, but there are many other lawyers like me who represent many of the same parties that I have, people with frozen assets, people overseas, people in the U.S. with cases against the government, compliance cases, people trying to come clean with the government. They're not on this list. It's me. Is it because my parents are from India? Is it because I'm Muslim? Because my name is Asim Ghaffour? I hate to have to even have this conversation, but that's really the only explanation. My understanding with FISA warrants and any kind of surveillance is that the U.S. government, agents, lawyers go through several steps of vetting. They go through several stages. At some point, somebody will say, you know, this is a lawyer. We can't really use information we're getting from him, so find another way to get information on him or just stop this. And I don't think that conversation ever happened.
I mean, weirdly, the feds mistakenly sent you this dossier, this log of your phone conversations with a client. That's a pretty big error, but I guess you must have been pleased to have at least known at that point.
Oh, it helped me a lot because unlike this case where we don't even know if the government was reading the contents of the email, in my case in 2004, I knew that the government not only gleaned that information from emails and phone calls, but used it against my clients. So the good news was we found out what the government was using against our clients illegally, and we were able to win those cases.
So it was email surveillance and phone surveillance. Any other forms of surveillance?
In the 2004 document and subsequent, by the way, I'm still not allowed to talk about the contents of the document. The government has threatened to prosecute me if I will. Hmm. So I can only talk about public information about the document. The President of the United States at the time, George Bush, a year later, 2005, admitted there was a terrorist surveillance program, which was very comprehensive. You scratch the surface, email and telephone. It could have been text messages, which wasn't as common back then, 10 years ago. It could have been any other communications, maybe even inside a room. Maybe they use the phone as a microphone when you're having a meeting with somebody. I've heard that the government can even use a cell phone off, even when it's powered down, as a microphone to record conversations. So in my case, I don't suspect it was that broad, but it was definitely email and phone calls.
In theory, in order to do this legally, I mean, you mentioned FISA courts earlier, a judge from FISA would have to say there was probable cause and that you were engaged in or abetting espionage, sabotage, or terrorism, right?
Right. And we've been told also in the context of the current story, the editor of The Intercept, John Cook, told me that in certain cases, absent a FISA warrant, if somebody's considered, even a U.S. citizen is considered a foreign person because they travel a lot overseas, that would require an authorization from the Justice Department as high up as the Attorney General to authorize a surveillance even without a FISA warrant. So it is a bit broader than just going to the FISA court and getting a warrant, which itself is a very, by nature, very untransparent and secretive process.
Even if your case was green-lighted by a FISA judge, do you still dispute the legality of the surveillance of you?
Unfortunately, the FISA court warrants have been upheld, and I'm not about to file a lawsuit to be the test case to say that the FISA court is illegal. So I would have to concede the legality. However, I will not concede the lack of knowledge and stupidity, really, of doing this. To me, it's not a question of legality and constitutionality as much if there is indeed a FISA warrant, as there is a common sense approach on, with a limited budget, with limited time, with limited resources, why is the government every 90 days for 3.5 years renewing a FISA warrant on me?
Attorney Asim Ghafoor, one of 5 Muslim Americans allegedly spied on by the NSA and FBI. Thanks for your time and for speaking with us.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
We contacted the National Security Agency for a response. The agency gave us a statement that said, in part, and I quote, "The United States is as committed to protecting privacy rights and individual freedom as we are to defending our national security," end of quote. Now, if you have questions for Asim Ghafoor, he'll be joining us tomorrow for a Facebook Q&A. Just go to facebook.com/PRI the world. That's tomorrow at 12 noon Eastern Time. Meanwhile, Germany is showing just how fed up it is with ongoing revelations of U.S. spying there. Today, the German government ordered the expulsion of a CIA official in Berlin. The move comes after allegations surfaced of 2 separate cases of alleged American spying in Germany. And of course, nobody there has forgotten the revelations that the NSA actually snooped on Chancellor Angela Merkel's personal phone. Jonathan Lawrence is a senior fellow of foreign policy at the Brookings Institution. He describes the fallout.
The officials in Germany say that nothing too serious was compromised, that it was more the Americans trying to get a sense of the discussions internal to the German intelligence and German foreign ministry. But of course, between such good friends, the Germans say, you know, why don't you just ask us? We'll tell you what we're thinking.
And do you think the Germans would supply information readily and easily if that request were made?
Well, it would depend on the issue. There are differences that come up in terms of negotiating approaches to the nuclear question in Iran regarding the approach to Putin in the crisis in the East Ukraine. So just like it came out that countries spy on one another before trade talks, it looks like countries also spy on one another before engaging in diplomatic negotiations.
Well, I mean, it's interesting because you're tipping to Ukraine and Putin kind of leads me to, isn't the bottom line here that this continues to happen because Germany can't do much more than just protest? I mean, Europe needs the U.S. support and tolerating some spying just might be the cost. What do you think?
To a certain extent, you're right. The Germans have accepted the security umbrella provided by the United States, provided by the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. So that we would be engaged in intelligence gathering in furtherance of that broad military stance is understandable, and I think that they basically get that too. Which is why there's no question of diplomatic relations being broken off. There's no question of tit for tat. This is pretty pro forma stuff. When spies are uncovered, their handlers get sent home. If anything, they have to show that they are not completely impotent vis-a-vis the Americans in order to retain the credibility of their own electorates.
Jonathan, if these spying scandals continue, could it affect German-U.S. cooperation over Russia, over Ukraine?
There may be a bit more mistrust, a bit more iciness in the room, since Germans have the sense that they really cannot trust their American counterparts. But the bottom line, and this is really just the realpolitik side of things, is that the U.S. and Germany share so many interests security-wise and economy-wise that to break up or chill relations because of a fairly routine case of a couple of low-level spies being caught would be, of course, a kind of own goal situation. It would be more damaging to the Germans themselves, since we are in the midst of negotiating a trade and investment partnership that would help Germany continue its dominance in exportation. And in the security situation as well, Germans don't want the United States to withdraw completely from Eastern Europe, because the fact is that Putin has shown that he's willing to intervene not only in Georgia, of course, but also in the Ukraine and even to annex parts of Europe. So I don't think the Germans are in any hurry to boot the Americans out, but they did have to just slap us on the wrist by expelling the CIA officials, because otherwise they would look like they were simply marionettes without any sovereignty of their own.
That own goal metaphor, a good one considering where Germany's headed on Sunday, huh?
Yeah, I think they're more likely to kick it into the other person's goal, but true enough.
Jonathan Lawrence, Senior Policy Fellow at the Brookings Institution. Thanks so much.
Thank you. Have a good day.
Okay, people, it's time for a Throwback Thursday pop quiz. Here's the question. What does Magna Carta mean? You don't know? Don't worry. British Prime Minister David Cameron had some trouble, too, when David Letterman asked him.
And the literal translation was what? You have Magna.
Again, you're testing me.
Boy, it'd be good if you knew this.
Yeah, well, it would be.
Magna Carta means Great Charter. Mr. Prime Minister, you could have guessed and gotten that one right. I mean, you're an Eton boy, right? Anyway, next year, the Great Charter celebrates its 800th anniversary. England's King John signed it in 1215, which basically established rule of law and limited the power of the monarchy. And it's been the foundation of the British government ever since. Some members of the UK Parliament, though, think a charter may be nice, but how about an actual constitution, like us?
If you talk to people in America or France or most of the democratic countries, you'll have a proper debate.
That's Member of Parliament Graham Allen.
The man in the street will know in America, pleading the fifth, they'll know bits of the Constitution. They'll have a pride about their rule book, if you like. But in Britain, it's sort of, you need sort of judicial archaeology before you can find out actually who does what and why. I think that leads to a bit of disengagement. It leads to a quite hierarchical and top-down society.
He's chairing the Constitutional Reform Committee, now drafting a United Kingdom constitution. They have a working draft, but they want the input of the nation.
Not just, as they say in the States, 40 white guys in a hall in Philadelphia make a constitution, but actually to have millions of potential founding fathers and mothers of a UK constitution.
Yep, you heard that right. Allen wants to crowdsource a new constitution, including a new preamble.
If we can get a few poets out there to put in something rousing and motivating as a preamble to our constitution, maybe that's another thing that might excite a bit more interest in British politics.
I don't know, though. That better-known preamble seems pretty hard to beat. It's got those unforgettable lines about forming a more perfect union, establishing justice, ensuring domestic tranquility.
God save the Queen!
Ah, yes. And while we're on the topic of the preamble to the U.S. Constitution, we came across a really cool piece of art by a guy named Mike Wilkins. He's written out the preamble on U.S. license plates from Alabama to Wyoming. The piece is at the Smithsonian American Art Museum, and we've got a great picture at PRI.org. You're listening to The World on PRI, Public Radio International. We're smack in the middle of the baseball season, all-star break on the horizon. But there's one boy of summer who's not seeing any action this year. Alex Rodriguez is serving a long suspension for using illegal performance-enhancing drugs, or PEDs. Last year, an expose in the Miami New Times newspaper revealed how A-Rod had been getting his PEDs from a Florida clinic called Biogenesis, run by a guy named Tony Bosch. But the story behind that story actually starts in Central America, in Belize. Reporter Tin Elfrink wrote that original expose. Now he's got a book out, co-written with Gus Garcia Roberts, called Bloodsport: Alex Rodriguez, Biogenesis, and the Quest to End Baseball's Steroid Era.
Well, it's a pretty fascinating backstory. Tony Bosch was a guy who came from a family with a number of prominent doctors, a Cuban-American family in Miami. But he never quite had the grades or the willpower to get into a U.S. Medical school. So back in 2007, he found his way into a place in Belize, just outside Belize City, called the Central American Health Sciences University. This school is particularly interesting because before Tony went there, probably its two most famous alumni were a man named Robert Goldman and his partner, Ronald Klatz, who are notable as the two men who helped found the American Association of Anti-Aging Medicine, or A4M, which became the foundation for this recently booming anti-aging industry in the United States. Tony Bosch saw this, number one, as a potentially lucrative business opportunity, but number two, as a guy who had always been interested in performance-enhancing drugs for athletics, as a very convenient way to get a foothold into an industry where you could have easy access to these kind of drugs. And this small, tiny school that's sort of located in a cleared-out jungle field about 15 minutes outside Belize City was the very unlikely starting point for that dream.
And Gus, did you get the sense that Tony Bosch went to Belize with a kind of longer-term plan in mind that just could not be kind of conceived in the United States?
Yeah, Bosch was, as Tim said, Bosch was a medical school dropout. He was a guy who just sort of lacked the drive to do this the right way, to become a doctor like other members of his family. I think that in Florida, the anti-aging industry is seen as a get-rich scheme by its operators. You'll see these clinics pop up all over the state. It's this kind of wild industry, and I think Bosch there, that could be his niche.
So after the stint at the Central American Health Sciences University in Belize, Bosch eventually returns to Florida, sets up this health clinic, Biogenesis, grew his client list, which did include pro ball players. He's kind of living his dream, but then his clinic shuts its doors, partly due to this expose that you wrote, Tim, last year. If I get this right, Major League Baseball sent in a covert police task force after your story broke?
That's right. To me, this is one of the most fascinating untold stories of this whole saga. It's a task force that's completely unique in professional sports in the United States called the Department of Investigations. This particular department was born after the famous report that Senator George Mitchell put together in 2007 after the last major steroid scandal, the Balco scandal. And his first recommendation to baseball was, you know, before getting to testing or any other reforms, was to create a essentially internal police force that could go out and investigate new steroid scandals. And Commissioner Bud Selig enthusiastically took up that recommendation, created this department, gave it millions of dollars in funding. They hired dozens of staffers, primarily former New York police officers. What happened that was so interesting is, you know, they sort of spent a number of years foundering for a mission because they had such an open-ended directive basically to protect baseball, to do whatever it took to keep the game clean and legitimate. And a lot of that involved overseas work. First was a major thorn in the side for owners were prospects coming out of the Caribbean, particularly the Dominican Republic, who were lying about their age and pretending to be younger than they were.
So how did these police get involved in a place like the DR?
Well, almost any time a top prospect would be up for millions of dollars in signing bonuses, they would launch investigations, you know, visit their hometown, talk to friends and family, scour for birth certificates, and eventually even do DNA testing, wow, all to prove that the prospect was the same age he said he was. You know, this obviously wasn't the kind of mission that Senator Mitchell had in mind when he recommended creating this force, but that's sort of the direction that baseball ended up pointing them.
So go ahead, Gus.
I was just going to expand on how they came into the biogenesis thing. I mean, the Department of Investigations is known for throwing around baseball's money in order to get what it wants. And when it came down to Florida, they spent hundreds of thousands of dollars buying records, some of which were stolen, known to be stolen, in order to gain evidence against Alex Rodriguez.
You're talking about medical records.
Yes, they took medical records from that used to belong to the biogenesis clinic that had names of clients, including Alex Rodriguez. So in a way, they took these tactics that they sort of honed in Latin America. They took them to the United States of America in Miami.
You know, Gus, one thread that runs through your book is that many major leaguers who dope either come from Latin America or have Latin American backgrounds. Does that suggest an especially intense push to succeed for these kids to the point that PEDs are just one of the tools to getting there?
Well, I think that there is a truth to that. I mean, one of the kids that we first reported that he was a biogenesis client, at the time that he first went to biogenesis, he was 15 years old. His name is Ricardo Cespedes, and he signed a contract for $725,000 on his 15th birthday with the New York Mets.
Wow.
And $725,000 to a kid who grew up in the Dominican Republic is a life-changing sum.
Yeah, I bet.
Tim here, and I just would add to that as well. You know, I think baseball freely admits that this problem is particularly difficult to address in the Dominican Republic and other Caribbean nations where, you know, drugs like steroids are so easy to obtain over the counter in a lot of cases. You know, one reason they say they sent so many investigators to the Dominican wasn't just for these, you know, age investigations, but because they believed that the same people who were faking ages and basically perpetuating these scams were also pressuring all these prospects to start doping at a very early age. Because again, it is a hugely life-changing sum of money that's on the table if they manage to stand out from the crowd.
If you've got actors like Tony Bosch going to places like Belize that, you know, are beyond U.S. borders, do you think Major League Baseball, especially since it turned a blind eye to doping for years, can it ever really stop doping?
I would say that the doping issue is not going to go away for Major League Baseball, even with its, you know, new, renewed and more aggressive efforts. You know, players that were suspended after biogenesis got huge contracts. Johnny Peralta signed a $50 million contract after his ban from biogenesis. Ryan Braun signed a $100 million plus contract the year that he tested positive for PEDs. So there's this extremely large incentive for these players to dope. Even if they're caught, the incentive still exists. You have this perfect storm where you have these affluent athletes and you have guys like Anthony Bosch who are on the cutting edge as far as evading the steroids police of various sports, and the athletes that are willing to pay them and are willing to do whatever they can to get an edge.
Tim Elfrink and Gus Garcia Roberts, the authors of Bloodsport, Alex Rodriguez, Biogenesis, and the Quest to End Baseball's Steroid Era, thank you so much.
Thanks a lot.
Thanks for having us.
This is PRI. I'm Marco Werman. So you're a foot soldier in ancient Greece, and you're about to go into battle wearing armor that looks like a kitchen apron, and it's made of linen.
If you were wearing one of these things in the ancient world between 600 and 200 BC, you would have been safe from any kind of arrows that would have been out there.
Take that, Kevlar. That story's just ahead on The World.
Support for PRI's The World comes from Medtronic, celebrating people living with medical technology who are giving back to their communities. Apply for the Bakken Invitation Award and earn a $20,000 charitable grant for your charity. Learn more at liveongiveon.org.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World, a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH in Boston. Escalation. That's one word that describes the depressingly familiar scenes we're witnessing in the Middle East this week. Israel today continued its airstrikes against targets in the Palestinian territory of Gaza, and Gaza militants responded by continuing their barrage of rocket fire against targets in Israel. The death toll in Gaza is escalating, too. It's now somewhere around 80 people killed, most of them civilians. Israeli officials say they're ready for a long fight with Hamas, the militant group that's controlled Gaza since 2007. Hamas also talks tough, but as the world's Matthew Bell reports, the militant group is fighting from a position of weakness. Hamas is calling on Palestinians to resist the Zionist enemy. That's code for taking up arms against Israelis. We know they are stronger than us, the exiled Hamas leader Khalid Meshaal said yesterday, but our people will not surrender. In a television interview, Hamas spokesman Sami Abu Zuhri was asked about reports of Palestinians in Gaza ignoring warnings from the Israeli military to leave buildings targeted for attack and then being killed in Israeli airstrikes. This attests to the character of our noble jihad-fighting people. We in Hamas, he goes on to say, call on our people to adopt this policy. Why is Hamas telling Palestinians to sacrifice themselves? For starters, there are theological reasons for doing so, says Ofer Salzberg, a Jerusalem-based analyst with the International Crisis Group.
This is about being willing to give up your life in order to advance such a noble goal. From their perspective, the goal, of course, is the liberation of sacred land for Islam, on which there should not be a non-Islamic sovereignty, and over which, eventually, ultimately, would be established the caliphate.
Salzberg says the religious meaning of martyrdom for militant Islam is a factor here, but he adds there's a practical reason why the call for self-sacrifice resonates. People in Gaza are under enormous daily stress, and they see this as a fight for their existence.
There are some things that are non-negotiable for all of us, and the population in Gaza has reached a situation in which essentially it's being asked to give up on things it is unable to give up on. Water, electricity are extremely scarce now.
There's also a propaganda war going on here, says Middle East expert Nathan Brown of George Washington University.
What Israel is trying to present this as is a war against Hamas, and Hamas is definitely the target here. What Hamas is trying to present this as is an Israeli attack on the Palestinian people. And so what they're trying to do, both for a domestic audience and an international audience, is to say it's not just about us, it's that Israelis are going after all Palestinians, civilians, Hamas, Fatah, it doesn't matter, we're all going to be punished by this brutal Israeli campaign. That seems to be the message they want to get across.
For Hamas in Gaza, this fight with Israel comes at a critical moment. The Islamic militant group lost its most important patron in Egypt last year when the Muslim Brotherhood-dominated government there was ousted. And Nathan Brown says Hamas was in danger of losing its credibility among the Palestinian public as the preeminent Islamic resistance movement.
Palestinians had been taunting it, saying that it wasn't doing anything very Islamic, it wasn't doing any resistance, and it wasn't really much of a movement, it was just concentrating on governing Gaza. And so what they seem to have been doing over the last few months is to try and recover their identity as a resistance movement.
Hamas recently signed a unity agreement with the leaders of the U.S.-backed Palestinian Authority in the West Bank. That makes the PA responsible for governing the Gaza Strip and its 1.7 million people, and it gives Hamas the opportunity to concentrate on quote-unquote resistance. Fawaz Jerjes is a Middle East expert at the London School of Economics.
Hamas is deeply embedded in Palestinian society. Millions of Palestinians look up to Hamas as a resistance movement, confronting Israeli military occupation, Palestinian territories, defying Israel's massive military machine, and drawing the attention of the world to the plight of the Palestinians.
At this point, Hamas doesn't have much to lose. Yes, some of its commanders will die in Israeli attacks, and Palestinian civilians will pay the heaviest price. But Israel does not appear to be in any mood to reinvade the Gaza Strip. So both sides will keep fighting for another ceasefire agreement, and Hamas will have successfully proven that it's here to stay. For The World, I'm Matthew Bell.
Jill Replogle is a reporter on the Fronteras desk at KPBS in San Diego. She regularly covers border issues for us here at The World, and she's done a lot of reporting in Guatemala. Her husband is Guatemalan, and she lived there for several years. 2 days ago, Jill tweeted this, and it got our attention. On the day Guatemala's first lady says kids aren't fleeing violence there, a paper counts 12 murders. The next day, my good friend is a victim. Jill Replogle, this is a really sad story. I'm sorry for your loss. Tell us what happened to your friend.
Yeah, her name was Patricia Samayoa Patti. She walked into a small pharmacy in Guatemala City to purchase something, And under still very murky circumstances, she was shot and killed by the security guard at the pharmacy. There are definitely some factors to indicate that the guard was not in his right mind. He holed up in the pharmacy after he shot her, wouldn't let anyone near the body for about an hour, and even shot and wounded one of the police officers who arrived at the scene.
And this was a private security guard?
Private security guard, of which there are, by some estimates, 150,000 in Guatemala. They outnumber police officers 4-1, possibly even 5-1. And when you walk down the streets of Guatemala City, or really nearly any city and even small towns in Guatemala, almost all of the stores, no matter how small and how little merchandise or money it seems like they might have, they almost all have armed guards.
And tell me a bit about your friend. I mean, what did she do? And I mean, was she kind of ever used to all these security guards around with these big guns?
Yeah, she was, well, first of all, just a really, really beautiful, fun-loving person. She hosted my wedding. She was really dedicated to making Guatemala a better place. She worked for 14 years for the city of Guatemala, running a program working with women in the city's poor neighborhoods, empowering them to take control of their lives in a very macho society. And she was one of the many people who had to go into exile during Guatemala's civil war, which ended in 1996. Back then, she was part of a student movement that was being targeted by death squads. And so she had to leave, but she came back to work for her country. And that's one of the things that just makes it so absurd that she was killed under these circumstances.
Yeah, it is pretty absurd. Now, these private security guards, I mean, 150,000 of them, where do they come from?
Well, in the past, after the war, there were, frankly, a lot of unemployed killers, a lot of soldiers and a lot of people who signed up for the guerrilla who didn't have a lot of training, but what they were trained to do was to fight the other side. And when the war ended, they were unemployed. Security started getting worse and worse with gangs and a lot of drug activity. And the industry just boomed, and a lot of these people got hired. Nowadays, it's a lot of displaced agricultural workers, a lot of people from rural areas who can't find jobs there. They move to the city, and one of the easiest jobs to get is as a private security guard.
Wow. And though it's seriously painful, I mean, this is not your first friend that's been killed, I understand.
No, I know six people who have been killed in Guatemala, six friends in the past 5 years or so, which seems like a lot for one gringa who lived there for less than a decade. A woman who was an anthropologist who was kidnapped in a rural area of Guatemala, and her body was thrown by the side of the road, again, under unclear circumstances. Almost all of the murders in Guatemala are never solved. I know two young men who both had gotten out of gangs and had tried to turn their lives around by working with an organization in the capital that does theater around the country and tries to pull young people out of gangs. They were both shot by their former gang members for getting out. So it's just it's really hard to be safe in Guatemala. It's hard to feel safe.
So it sounds like this big problem of violence there also extends to those who try and combat it, like these private security guards. But you've also come close to the violence of these gangs. I mean, one friend killed, bad enough, but six. I mean, how do you even process that?
I think the way that a lot of people do in Guatemala, you have to shut it out. I mean, you shut it out or you leave. And clearly this phenomenon that we're seeing now of all these children coming to the border and not just children. I mean, there have been adults, huge increase in adults from Central America coming in the last few years as well. But people become hardened and also depressed and, you know, less and less willing to work to try to make the country a better place. And that's just one of the saddest things to see.
Jill Replogle, great to speak with you. Thanks very much for telling us about this.
Thanks, Marco.
It's eerie what military technology can do these days. But in ancient Greece, they thought they were cutting edge when they developed the linothorax. Linothorax, lino referring to linen, thorax meaning the chest. What's a linothorax? get in your mind's eye an ancient Greek warrior, his sword in the air, an olive branch on his head, and around his midriff, one of these pleated shirt skirts, if you will. Got it? That's a linothorax. This garment raises some interesting questions, mainly, how could what amounts to a kitchen apron serve the same purpose as Kevlar? So, Gregory Aldrete, you dug into this. You're a history professor at the University of Wisconsin, Green Bay. How did a piece of linen actually protect warriors?
Well, the secret is that you take a bunch of layers of linen and you laminate or sew them together. And when you do that, you get something which is very tough and also flexes a bit when things hit it, so it disseminates the force, and it turns out to be quite effective protection.
You laminate it with what?
Well, one of our goals when we had this project was to try and recreate some of these using materials that were as close as possible to what they would have had in the ancient world. So this meant getting our hands on some linen, which had not only been hand-woven and hand-sewn, but also harvested and grown by traditional methods. And that turned out to be quite a challenge, but we did it in the end. And then we also had to use glues, which they might have had, and the glue we settled on was rabbit glue, which is what it sounds like, glue made from the skins of rabbits. And we knew that would have been very cheap and widely available in the ancient world. So once we had those materials in hand and we did some research to figure out the patterns, we started trying to make them.
And does history show us that these linothoraxes were, in fact, several layers of linen held together by rabbit glue? I mean, is that how they did it back in ancient Greece?
Well, it's one plausible reconstruction. I mean, unfortunately, we don't have an exact how-to description of how they made this. What we do have is about 60 sources from ancient authors, that mention linen armor. And in addition, what my team did was to locate about 1,000 images of this armor on Greek vases, wall paintings, all sorts of things. And so we kind of had to backwards engineer it. And for example, we know that the Greeks used this kind of lamination of linen technology in other contexts. They used it to make some of those masks that they wore in theaters. Archaeologists have found little fragments of laminated linen in graves. So we know they had this, and it seems the most likely explanation for something called a linothorax, a linen piece of armor.
So little fragments, but no complete linothorax. Is that because the linen and rabbit glue just decomposes over time?
Yes, and that's why this is such a mystery, because archaeologists like to study what they can lay their hands on, and simply no examples of this have survived because it's made of organic materials. So even though it's mentioned in text, even though it shows up in images, people had always been a little bit skeptical about it. They always thought, well, maybe this was some kind of secondhand armor, that you would only wear this if you were desperate. And it had been ignored, quite honestly, in scholarship.
Right, and now you know it could have been good armor because you made some linothoraxes and got one of your several students to wear them. And then what happened next?
So we made 7 complete reconstructions of this, and I had my students run around, wear them for 20 hours, wear them in a rainstorm, jump around, do all the sorts of movements to assess the wearability issues. And then the second thing was the testing. And for that, we actually made some flat test panels where we actually made dozens of these. So we made all kinds of different variables, thickness, weave, and then shot them with arrows under controlled conditions. And our bottom line result was that if you were wearing one of these things in the ancient world between 600 and 200 BC, you would have been safe from any kind of arrows that would have been out there. It offered as good protection as the thickest bronze armor, but it only 1/3 the weight.
Wow. What is linen? Remind us. It's not cotton, is it?
No. Linen is made from the flax plant, and it's a very versatile fiber. It's a little hard to process, but it has some nice qualities. It resists stains well. It's not doesn't stretch very much, but it keeps you cool. I mean, that's why people wear linen shirts in hot weather. So in the hot, 100-degree Mediterranean sun, if you're traipsing around ancient Persia or Greece, it made a big difference to be wearing linen armor versus bronze. If you were encased in a bronze breastplate, it would basically bake you.
Now, I understand you're getting questions about your linothorax project as far afield as Hollywood.
Probably the oddest request is I had someone send me an email who was a designer of role-playing games, and he was doing a game based on the zombie apocalypse and wanted to know, would this armor be good protection against a zombie bite? And after thinking about it a bit, I had to say, yes, it probably would.
Greg Aldrete, a professor of history at the University of Wisconsin-Green Bay, thanks for telling us about your linothorax project.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
You can see how the University of Wisconsin students recreated that ancient armor, rabbit glue and all. We've posted pictures and a video at PRI.org. Next on The World, Garth Brooks in Dublin and Creedence in Buenos Aires. All will be revealed in a minute on PRI.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from Lumosity.com, personalized brain training programs developed by neuroscientists to challenge memory, attention, and problem-solving through games. More at Lumosity.com.
I'm Marco Werman. You're tuned in to The World.
Blaming all of my roots, I showed up in boots and ruined your blind tie affair.
Country music fans in Ireland are reeling. Yep, there are apparently lots of Irish fans of American country music. And they were so looking forward to five concerts in Dublin later this month by the king of country, Garth Brooks. They were supposed to be the kickoff to the singer's much-anticipated worldwide comeback tour. But then Dublin City Council said no to five consecutive days of concerts. It approved only three. Brooks and his entourage responded by pulling the plug on all the Dublin gigs.
Garth Brooks is like God in Ireland. I mean, American country music is huge here.
Alana Fearon is a reporter with the Irish Daily Mirror.
When the Garth Brooks comeback gigs were initially announced, there were to be two in Croke Park, which is the headquarters of GAA football here. The demand was such that the promoters increased that to three, then four, and then ultimately five. So there was 400,000 people waiting to get to these concerts later this month. Then hearts broke everywhere when this furore broke. I mean, it's been huge. It's dominating everything. The airwaves, the newspapers, Facebook is just alight with worried fans, you know, asking what's happening now. It did look like there was absolutely no hope and that the gigs were cancelled until yesterday when Garth appealed directly to the government here to intervene. And there are crunch talks going on in Dublin. You know, it's in a desperate bid to thrash out some sort of happy medium which will allow Garth to come here and please those crowds that are so looking forward to seeing him.
Wow, so Garth Brooks's people are talking to the Irish national government about this. This is like serious.
Oh yeah, this is really serious. I mean, this is worth a staggering €50 million to our economy. You know, the buzz that it would bring back to the streets of Dublin would be phenomenal. It's five nights. You know, it's the king of country, as he would be known here, coming back to the stadium where he last performed in 97. You know, I mean, some of our clothes chains here are selling Stetson hats, cowboy boots are flying off the shelves. I mean, it really has been a carnival atmosphere, really, since the tickets went on sale in January. I have friends who bought tickets to go three nights back to back.
Oh, my God.
But people were just so excited to see him back in Ireland. And now it's descended into this mess.
Well, we had our people at the BBC spoke with a woman from Londonderry, Anne Thompson, who bought 12 tickets to the concerts.
It was a lifetime thing for me. Garth Brooks has been a lifetime idol for me from he was ever heard of. And quite honestly, I am totally devastated. Absolutely, totally devastated.
She is upset. So I know country and Western is a close cousin to Irish music, but Garth Brooks is kind of rock country. What is the appeal of Garth Brooks in Ireland, do you think?
You know, for a lot of Irish people here, and even, you know, I suppose it would have been the older generation when you had, you know, like dances, as they were called, people would have danced those music. And it's just filtered into the next generation. And I mean, it's the fun, it's the getting up and dancing and singing along. You really feel with Garth uniquely, he really, you know, feels an affinity with Ireland. And it's very obvious when he's here or when he speaks about Ireland, how much love he has for the country. And it's completely mutual. You know, I mean, 400,000 people is equivalent to 10% of the population of this country.
Wow, yeah.
Now, you know, we have people that are going for their honeymoon to Garth Brooks. We've brides that actually considered cancelling their weddings for Garth Brooks. I think everybody, you know, whether you're going or not, is behind these peace talks, as we could call them, in, you know, please salvage it in some way. It's going to be a bit of a logistical nightmare as well when if nothing goes ahead and you know, €26 million in tickets need to be refunded.
Don't give up hope yet. Alana Fearon, a reporter with the Irish Daily Mirror, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
Finally today, there are only two games left in the World Cup. Brazil and the Netherlands will battle it out for third place on Saturday, and in the final on Sunday, Germany face Argentina. Brazilians, as we've reported here on The World, are distraught at being shut out of the final on home soil, and a decisive hammering defeat at that. But compounding that home turf nightmare is that arch-rivals Argentina could be the ones that lift the World Cup trophy on Sunday in Brazil. There's no love lost between the two South American soccer powers. Here's proof of that if you needed any. Those are Argentina's players celebrating one of their victories in the tournament with a chant that asks, "Brazil, tell me how it feels to be bossed around in your own home," rubbing their face in it. Did you recognize the tune, by the way? Yep, it's the melody to Creedence Clearwater Revival's Bad Moon Rising. Argentine sports reporter Marcela Mora y Araújo was in Brazil for the World Cup. She's now back in Argentina and says everyone there is singing it.
Being chanted by the players themselves in the dressing room in a video that's gone viral on the internet, and children sing it, people hum it. It's amazing, and it's one of those, you know, catchy tunes with catchy lyrics that's just in everyone's mouth all the time.
Marcela points out the chant is especially popular because it doesn't use profanity to poke fun at Brazilians, but it does refer to Brazil as Argentina's child. And that, says Marcela, is not a compliment.
Referring to someone as your son or your child isn't flattery at all. But paternity is anything but healthy link. And it has to do with submission and maybe with saying in a certain way, you're rubbish or you're my slave even. So it's quite a strong intention.
Sports reporter Marcela Mora y Araújo speaking with us from Argentina. The family analogy goes both ways, by the way. Our editor William Troop is just back from Brazil, and he says that during the World Cup, Brazilian media have been referring to Argentines as our brothers, but it's often right before a story on how some visiting Argentine fans have been causing trouble. So with Argentina in the World Cup final, bad moon rising indeed for Brazilians in Rio. Someone's in for nasty weather this weekend. That's all from us today. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH, I'm Marco Werman. Thank you for being with us.